What drives people to commit murder?
What interests me in crime fiction isn't necessarily the puzzle of the murder or the gore element of the murder. I'm more interested in what would take somebody to the point of killing somebody else and what are the implications of that.
That's crime fiction writer Tana French. We talk with her about her terrific new novel, The Secret Place. And what would you do if your fiancé told you he'd killed somebody?
He said, there's something that you need to know about me right away. And he said, you need to know that I am on parole with a life sentence and I was in prison for 10 years. He had, in essence, gotten into an argument that got very out of control very quickly and became very violent with his then 38-year-old female roommate. And he took her life.
That's Shannon Maroney. Her memoir, Through the Glass, tells an incredible story about crime, justice, and redemption. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks so much for joining us today. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We all like to think of ourselves as incapable of violence. Those who commit extreme acts of violence, including murder, must be evil. They couldn't possibly have anything in common with us, could they? Today we examine two books, one a novel, the other a memoir, that explore the complex forces that can drive a person to extreme violence. Both books prompt us to mix understanding, and perhaps even compassion, with condemnation as we ponder the thin lines between right and wrong. Tana French's new novel, The Secret Place, is the latest in her Dublin Murder Squad series. The first, In the Woods, won the 2007 Edgar Award for Best First Novel. Since then, Tana French has continued to wow readers and critics with four more in the series. All are notable for their in-depth character development, plumbing the depths of the human heart to tease out what motivates us to do good and evil. That's an eternal theme. But French's novels also explore how contemporary forces shape individual motivations. In her 2012 novel, Broken Harbor, it was the collapse of the Irish housing market in the financial crash of 2008. Her latest book, The Secret Place, unfolds within status-driven teenage culture in our hyper-connected digital age. An upper-class boy at an Irish prep school has been murdered, and now, a year later, the unsolved mystery is reopened by a provocative message at the boy's sister school, a message that seems to come from one of the female students. The investigation brings to light a whole mess of power struggles between the girls at the school, between adults and kids, between the sexes, and between the detectives themselves. It's a fascinating read, and by the time the perpetrator is revealed, the reader has come to care about all the characters because they each contain the shifting patterns of light and dark that comprise our souls. Well, Tana French, welcome to Writer's Voice. The Secret Place is the fifth of your Dublin Murder Squad series, and it features a character from A Faithful Place, a previous novel, and that's Holly Mackey. Her dad also makes a minor appearance. In the previous book, she was a kid, and now she's a teenager boarding at the exclusive St. Kilda's School in Dublin. Tell us about Holly and how she begins the action rolling in this wonderful new book.
I liked writing Holly when I was writing Faithful Place. She was a 9-year-old then, and she was feisty, intelligent, devious, loving and loyal, and also very independent. And I thought that was an interesting combination of qualities and would probably make her into a very interesting person. But I didn't think at the time that I'd be coming back to her in any way. But when I started writing Secret Place, when I started thinking about it, I realized that this was going to be a book about teenagers, about their secrets, and I realized that Holly would be the perfect age to be that teenager, and that she would be actually, in plot terms as well, the perfect person to begin this, because it begins with Stephen Moran, who also showed up in Faithful Place, is in cold cases now and really wants his break to get onto the murder squad. And he gets it one day when Holly shows up in his office with a postcard that she's found on The Secret Place, which is the board, the secrets board, where girls in her school are allowed to pin up secrets anonymously, anything they want to reveal while still staying anonymous. And Holly has found a postcard on that board that has a photograph of a boy who was murdered on the school grounds a year ago, and the caption says, "I know who killed him." And she brings that postcard into Stephen, who now has to figure out what to do with it.
Yeah, and therein lies the tangled tale, which you tell marvelously. This is there are two groups of girls in this exclusive school. Holly's group is four best friends, and another group who are enthralled to their leader. Two very different kinds of groups. They seem to each represent kind of an opposed stance to social expectations. Is that right?
Yeah, that's absolutely. I'm very glad that comes through, because that's very much what I had in mind. To a large extent, this is a book about identity, about how you figure out who you are, which is, of course, central to being a teenager, and how you decide who you're going to allow to define you. Like, are you going to simply be defined by who you feel that you are? Are you going to let yourself be defined by your friends, by the authority figures, teachers and parents, by the media images of what you should be, by your peers? Who are you going to let make that decision? And the two groups of girls tend towards the opposite ends of the spectrum on that. Like, Holly's group are very intent on defining themselves, some of them more than others, whereas the other group, Joanne's, who are more kind of the standard idea of what mean teenage girls are like, they're very much defining themselves based on their received images, what they see expected of them, in everything from reality shows to glossy magazines to songs. They're taking on all these images and trying to turn themselves into what they're expected to be, or what they think they're expected to be. Whereas on the other end, Holly's lot want to decide for themselves who they are, and one in particular, Becca, has absolutely no time for what anyone's expectations of her are. She is going to be what she wants to be. And I'm not sure that either extreme is really healthy, because if you're allowing yourself to be entirely defined by society's projected expectations, then there's no there. You don't know who you are. If you were stranded on a desert island, if Joanne or one of her friends were stranded with no media input, she'd basically dissolve in a little puff of pink glittery fluff. You know, she doesn't know who she is without that input. Whereas on the other end, if you get Becca, the opposite extreme, who refuses to acknowledge any outside influence, that's not necessarily healthy either, because you do live within the world. You do need to interact with it and pay attention to the other people who you're living with, who you want to share this world with. And I don't think either extreme is necessarily a good idea.
Yes, and you do this within, you know, very much within the context, as you say, of adolescent self-identity. And I just thought this was, you had it so spot on. I mean, not only the dialogue, which was amazing, and as well as the texting back and forth, which was, I mean, I learned an awful lot.
Yeah.
It's changed the way I text. But you also have this issue of identity come up in the other two main characters, which is Stephen Moran, who is the one of the detectives, and then the head detective in this case, Antoinette Conway. They're also struggling on both sides of this identity divide and social expectations.
Yes, very much so. And again, they're very polarized by it, because Stephen is a people pleaser. He's quite malleable. He's very ready to be whatever people want him to be, whatever people expect him to be. And partly that's because he's very ambitious and he isn't what he wants to be. He's constantly hoping for the job or the person who will turn him into this elegant, erudite, effortless person who he dreams of being. And so he's very open to suggestion from outside. Whereas Antoinette is the exact opposite. She is who she is, and she absolutely refuses to bend in any way to anybody else's expectations. Anyone who doesn't like what she is can get lost. And so they're not exactly the ideal pair at the outset. Neither one of them is particularly pleased to find themselves spending the day with the other.
And yet, in some ways, they are the ideal pair. I mean, it's so fascinating how the interrelationships unfold in this book, with the girls also, but particularly in the intensity of the relationship of these two characters, the effect that they actually have on each other. Talk a little bit about that.
Yes, they do. Like I was saying, they start off not like being very much the antithesis of what the other one wants in any kind of partner. But gradually, not just through working together, but through the case, that changes. I mean, the case exposes them very intensely to how powerful a thing friendship can be. Stephen goes in there thinking that this elite private girls' boarding school, he loves it for its beauty, and he thinks that the beauty comes from the amount of money and age and things that have been poured into this school, and gradually realizes that it's nothing to do with that. The beauty that he sees in the girls' friendships comes from what they personally have put into it, for the amount of trust and the amount of risk and the willingness to sacrifice themselves for each other in very real and powerful ways that have been put into it. So the case changes him and his idea of who he is and how to define that. And in the same way, Antoinette, who goes into it really not liking this school at all because she sees it as an expression of a kind of elitism and worship of money and class that she's got absolutely zero time for. But by the end, she's seeing that the emotions that underlie this case, the passions and the love in many ways that underlie this case are not superficial and they're not shallow. They're very real things and they're very powerful. And so both of them are changed by this case. They don't just solve it. It changes them as well.
And if you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with novelist Tana French about her latest crime fiction novel, The Secret Place. It's the fifth in her Dublin Murder Squad series. And I wonder if you could also bring in now the theme of loyalty. You know, I think you really plumb the depths of loyalty as well as limits. And, you know, this is kind of a very personal echo of social expectations. It's the personal expectations that arise out of these relationships.
Yes, and these are, I think, some of the most intense relationships you ever form. Are teenage friendships, and they are life-defining because at that age you're figuring out who you are, and if you're figuring this out in tandem with your best friends, then who they see does define who you are at that moment in your life when those impressions last. And I think for all of these girls, these friendships become life-defining, and they start to measure who they are and assess who they are in terms of what they're willing to do for each other. And that question isn't just theoretical. By the end of the book, for all of them, that's become very strongly, a very concrete question with very high stakes. And all of them, in some way, betray the others. They're put in situations where, no matter what they do, they have to choose between one form of loyalty and another. And for each of them, that's a very hard choice.
Yeah. And there's a real sense of tragedy that I felt in this book. I mean, you lime these characters so beautifully. One really gets to care about them. And crime fiction, you know, obviously terrible, tragic things happen. But most of the time when one reads it, you don't have a sense of tragedy. If anything, you know, it's kind of a sense of fun. Who done it? But in this, there really is. Is that something that you felt as well as you were writing these characters?
Yes, very much so. That's kind of what interests me in crime fiction, isn't necessarily the puzzle of the murder or the gore element of the murder. I'm more interested in what would take somebody to the point of killing somebody else, and what are the implications of that? It's also why I don't usually have evil villains, because why an evil person does something evil, there's nothing mysterious about that. It's, you know, it's just because. But when you get somebody who is not evil, who feels compassion, feels love, and is not inherently cruel, has no desire to hurt anyone else, what would take them to the point where they feel that it's not just desirable but necessary to kill someone, and what would the implications be for them and everyone around them? I think there's no way for that to be anything other than devastating. And I also think if the victim becomes a real character, it's so easy for the victim to get eclipsed because, kind of by definition, they're dead for most of the book, so it's quite hard for them to become real. But if they do, and I had the opportunity because of the way I'd structured this book, where there's one timeline of the investigation through one day, but there's another timeline of the 18 months leading up to the murder from the girl's perspective. And that gave me an opportunity to bring the victim much more to life, and also to bring to life the possibility of a world in which they hadn't done it, to bring to life the possibility that how would things have gone if the murderer hadn't committed the crime. That, I think, that brings home the sadness of it, because you're much more aware that it isn't inevitable, that there are moments where this might not have happened, and that tragedy could have been averted.
Yeah, that was exactly my sense. You know, I had to reflect on that, which one usually doesn't in these in crime fiction. You know, that kind of brings me to the point. The victim is a boy. He's a teenager from the brother school of St. Kilda's, right across the road. You know, the teenage boys, they don't come off too well in this book. But he's a complex character and kind of indicates that there, if one had the opportunity, there might be more complex characters in more than just him or one or two of the other boys. Talk about the shaping of him, of this character.
He is, I mean, clearly he's not getting as much space because of, yeah, being dead for the present timeline. But Chris Harper is somebody who's having the exact same problems with defining himself as the girls are, because he's handsome, he's charismatic, he's popular, and everybody is projecting onto him what they expect a guy like that to be. They expect him to be kind of a Lothario, they expect him to be slightly dismissive of other people's feelings, they have all their expectations in place, and he's never had a chance to decide whether those actually fit who he is. And through the flashback timeline, he's trying to carve out a space in which he can experiment with different people that he could be and figure out who he actually is. And this is just as much of a problem for him as for the girls. And he doesn't necessarily do it in healthy ways, is trying to carve out a space to find out who he is. But he is trying to do it. He's not just some one-note heartthrob jock, mean guy, the way some people want to see him. It's just that people are projecting their expectations onto him, whatever those expectations may be.
Mm, yeah. Talk a little bit more about the structures. You say the investigation is over one day. Why did you choose that concentrated stage with which to write that part of the book?
For one thing, I liked the contrast with, I knew the girl's story was going to have to arch over the entire time that encompassed the storyline, all the events leading up to the murder, and that would necessarily take months and months. And I wanted to have a very tight timeline to contrast. But also, I didn't want the detectives leaving that school once they were in it. I wanted it to be that once they were in that location, that tight bubble of kind of slightly cabin fevery, very isolated world, I didn't want them to be able to leave until they had found the solution to the mystery. If they leave, it dilutes that energy, it dilutes the power of that world, because they can escape, they can take a breather, they can come back fresh. They needed to stay in there, feeling that pressure tighten around them until they had an answer.
And just on a kind of a minor note, Holly's father, who appears in as a main character in the previous book, A Faithful Place, he comes on. Now, I haven't read Faithful Place, although I will be, because I just downloaded it to my phone today. he comes off as kind of a sinister character. Is that the way he was in the first book? I mean, he's kind of threatening. I didn't really much like him.
He's definitely a morally ambiguous character, in that knows exactly what his priority list is. He is absolutely willing to sacrifice anything from low down on the priority list for the sake of something higher up on the priority list. And in this case, he's completely willing to throw both Stephen and Antoinette under a bus without a second thought when it seems like his daughter is in danger. And he does it, he moves on without even thinking twice about it. And that, I think it's fun, it's always fun to write, because most of us spend a fair amount of time trying to work out right from wrong, trying to be sure that we're getting this right and that we're doing the right thing, and he doesn't. He knows what his priorities are, and that's all that matters. And that kind of certainty can be a lot of fun to write. But it does make him a contrast in this book to the other characters who are less sure of who they are and what matters to them, because he's absolutely 100% positive. But it doesn't necessarily make him a pleasant guy, no. And in fairness, he's not at his finest in this book, though, because when he comes on the scene, his daughter is under threat, and he is in full-on war mode.
Yeah. This book, The Secret Place, Tana French, seems to blend genres. I mean, it's a straight-up mystery, and that's the main focus of the book, but there are also elements of the supernatural, and I wondered why you put them into the mix.
Well, I like mysteries. That's what I like about the crime genre. I don't even care what kind. I like real, fictional, solved, unsolved. I love them all. I just love the sense of mystery, the sense that we don't necessarily know everything. And I think it's a very human trait. Human beings are much more interested in mystery than most animals. Like, if you offer an animal something mysterious, the animal will check, you know, can I eat it? Is it dangerous? Nah, okay, I'll wander off. Whereas human beings are fascinated with mystery for its own sake. We put the amount of time and energy we put into mysteries that are unsolvable is unbelievable. And I love that. I've always loved mysteries. And for me, that was just an added dimension of mystery to the book. There's a mystery of who killed Chris Harper, but there are other mysteries. I like the points where the boundaries that we consider clear-cut start to turn a little bit blurry, a little bit permeable for the right person in the right time and place. And there are elements of the supernatural throughout the girl's storyline, but I made it I was very careful to make it clear in the detective storyline, there's always a rational explanation for everything. It's not that the supernatural is taken for granted in the book as a whole. It is in the girl's storyline. Reading that, yes, that's absolutely what's happening. But when the detectives are in the detective storyline, there's nothing supernatural going on at all. There's like bad wiring and a hefty dose of teenage hysteria. And I wanted to leave it up to the reader to decide which of those is the actual case.
And yet the detectives are also perfectly willing to use the supernatural to get the information they want to.
Oh, yeah, and I think probably you have to be as a detective, because what you're dealing with is so high stakes, and it's one of the things that fascinates me about detectives. They're dealing with life and death and truth and justice. And me, I have a bad day at work and there are too many adjectives. If they have a bad day at work, somebody could die. And I think when you're in that situation, you have to be the kind of person who's very open to whatever comes to hand and very ready to use whatever comes to hand. And one of the things that does come to hand for the detectives in this book is this sense of boundaries being permeable, the sense of the girls being very willing to blur away from what we normally consider reality. And yeah, they're very willing to stir that up and see what pops out.
Yeah, and then finally, we did talk a bit, maybe even more than a bit, about Stephen Moran and Antoinette Conway. I'd like to ask you a little bit about Antoinette, because she also is not particularly a likable character. She's a complex person. What drives her? And, you know, I kind of wonder, going on from here, can she ever actually make it in the murder squad? And maybe you could talk about what her position within that squad is and what drives her and, you know, just her whole position as in her profession there.
Well, there's a lot of power play going on in the murder squad that she's part of. And in some of my other books, it hasn't been that kind of squad. But, you know, any community is going to change and shift over time. And the murder squad that she's a part of is very power-driven, very competitive. And the fact that she's a woman is being used against her. Because in an environment where people are using power play and jockeying for position, anything that can be used against you will. And it's not necessarily about her being a woman, but that is something that can be used. It's being used as a weapon to keep her in her place, more or less. And she isn't the type who will adapt around that. She's not the type who's willing to make any concessions to try and, make people like her. She just is who she is. And I'm in the process of finding out whether she can ever make it in the murder squad. I'm working on my sixth book, and she is the narrator this time. She's still in the murder squad. It still is not going very well for her. And she runs into what looks at first like a standard routine domestic murder case, except that she starts to discover that somebody on the squad doesn't want her to solve it. And she has to figure out, is it just because people really do hate her enough to scupper her case to get rid of her, or is there also something else going on?
Well, I totally look forward to reading the next one in this series, in the series of the Dublin Murder Squad. And I hope, Tana French, I'll be able to talk with you about that one. I want to thank you so much for talking with us about the fifth one here, The Secret Place. I thoroughly enjoyed it. I just loved it. And thanks for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for having me.
We spoke with Tana French, award-winning crime fiction writer, about her latest terrific novel, The Secret Place. You can read an excerpt at writersvoice.net. Tana French is the award-winning writer of the Dublin Murder Squad series. You can read an excerpt from The Secret Place by going to writersvoice.net. Next up, we hear a true story of crime and restorative justice. Stay tuned.
The Beast in Me is caged by frail and fragile bars, restless by day and by night, rants and rages at the stars. God help the beast in me. The beast in me has had to learn to live with pain and how to shelter from the rain. And in the twinkling of an eye, might have to be restrained. God help beast in me. Sometimes it tries to kid me that it's just a teddy bear, and even somehow manage to vanish in the air. And that is when I must beware of the beast in me.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. When Canadian school guidance counselor Shannon Maroney married her husband Jason, she knew that he had murdered a woman when he was a teenager and been imprisoned for the crime. He had told her that on their first date. But she thought, as did the Canadian prison that had released him after serving 10 years of his life sentence, that he was fully rehabilitated. The Jason she knew was kind and gentle. So when Maroney found out that Jason had committed another heinous crime while she was away at a conference, the brutal kidnapping and rape of two women, her whole picture of her marriage and her husband was shattered. Who was Jason, really? How could he have done such terrible things? Was his love for her a sham? Could the victims of his crime ever get justice? And what would justice for the victims look like? Those victims were, first of all, the women he brutalized. But Shannon Maroney was also a victim. And was it possible that Jason had once been a victim of crimes as well? Crimes that had set him on his course of unpredictable violence? Maroney's memoir, Through the Glass, takes the reader on her remarkable journey toward understanding what justice truly is. Restorative justice, a justice that goes beyond punishment to healing. Through the Glass was published in Canada in 2011. It's out now in a U.S. edition from Penguin Random House.
Well, Shannon Maroney, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Your book, Through the Glass, is about the incredible emotional and spiritual journey you traversed after your husband was arrested for the brutal sexual assault and kidnapping of two female customers who came into the store he was working in at the time. I'd like you to start out first by telling us a little bit about how did you meet your husband and what was your understanding of him and his history just before this happened?
Sure. So I met my husband early in 2003, so almost 3 years before the day that you're talking about, before I learned about these crimes. I met him, I was a high school guidance counselor, and I took a group of my students, I was a teacher supervisor, to our school's respect committee, and the students were volunteering at a local soup kitchen in the city that we lived in. A small city in Ontario. And there at the soup kitchen, I met Jason Staples, who was the assistant coordinator and head chef at the, it wasn't a soup kitchen, we called it a restaurant for low-income patrons. It was a fabulous organization that allowed people in need to come in and be served a meal for just a dollar, but be treated as if they had paid $100 for that meal. And so when I first met Jason, I thought he was very attractive. He was, you could see instantly that he was very beloved at this organization. I was impressed by the way that he handled a large team of volunteers, as well as close to 200 clients or more who came through the doors of the organization a few times a week for a meal. And, I just liked him. Just like anybody, just sort of have a spark for somebody else. And so I was really happy when he asked me if I'd like to go out for a cup of tea that evening. So I met him at one of our local cafes, and we ordered our tea and sat down. And then immediately he said, "There's something that you need to know about me right away." And I thought, what could this be? And he said, "You need to know that I am on parole with a life sentence, and I was in prison for 10 years. And I was just totally shocked. Here I was sitting across the table from someone that, although I'd only known him for a few weeks, I'd seen him. I mean, there was just nothing about him that would make you think he could have killed someone. And yet I knew that is exactly what must have happened, because that's the only way that you can have a life sentence in Canada, where I live. And so I just felt I had to listen to him, I guess. I mean, people say to me now, "Why don't you just get up from the table and walk away?" And I think there's a few different reasons for that. One was that I really appreciated how honest he was being. I didn't really know if it was me, would I be that forthright with somebody knowing that they could just walk out of my life. I felt in my professional role as a counselor, I was used to and trained for how to sit across the table from someone and listen to a difficult story. And I think part of it was just shock too. I just felt almost like I couldn't move as he said these words. And so Jason filled me in on what had happened when he was 18 years old. And he was, at the time that we were having this conversation, it was 15 years later. So he was 33. He had, in essence, gotten into a argument that got very out of control very quickly and became very violent with his then 38-year-old female roommate, and he took her life. He pled guilty to a charge of second-degree murder, and the judge in his case saw his youth. He was just a couple of months after his 18th birthday, and his potential for rehabilitation, the fact that he'd never been involved in criminality in any other way, never in trouble at school, and so on and so forth. And so he was given a sentence of life 10, eligible for parole after 10 years. He served those 10 years. He was reported to be the model inmate. I mean, he was telling me he sort of had no problems inside. And later I went on to confirm that information. And he was released into the community after 10 years, believed to have been rehabilitated, having lots of support from some excellent programs and people in the community who help offenders to reintegrate. And he'd been living very, very successfully for 5 years by the time we were talking. So I took all this in. I felt distressed. I felt, you know, any sort of lighthearted spark that I'd felt or butterflies in my stomach that I'd had leaving to go out on this date were completely gone and just replaced with this, like a burden, you know, a heavy burden and just this, you know, kind of, what do I do? Why have I met this person? And if I want to even know him as a friend or someone I'm going to continue working with, I think that I need to understand more, and let alone if I ever, you know, if I think I'm going to have a relationship with him. You know, and I have to say that the feeling that I had was I felt really sad, you know, looking at Jason and just thinking the sadness for his victim, whose life he took, and her family, the sadness for him as this 18-year-old that had lived 10 years in prison. And it was just all, it was all very, very sad to me. Jason said, you know, if you would like, you can talk to my parole officer, you can talk to my psychologist. And I thought that seemed like a very good idea. You know, I felt that I had to be very much head over heart in this circumstance. And my feelings of sadness or sort of an innate compassion couldn't overwhelm me. And I needed really information and facts. So I then sort of went on a process of meeting with his psychologist, parole officer, the people in the system who knew him well, who'd known him for years, and reading the reports and everything said, you know, he is a model of the redemptive powers of our system. We do not believe he will ever reoffend. He's never been violent again. He's got support. He's got a future. And that's what our focus is on.
And so you had this information and official confirmation that he would not reoffend, that he was well rehabilitated, and you and he got married. And then you found yourself, soon after your marriage, you found yourself at a conference for guidance counselors. You're back in your hotel room. You answer a phone call from a police officer. What happened?
So yes, on the morning of November the 8th, I'd been married 1 month, November the 8th, 2005. We had a beautiful, beautiful wedding. I woke up in a hotel room where I was, as you said, attending a guidance counselor's conference. And that morning, actually, I remember waking up and I thought that I might be pregnant. I'd had a few different signs. And the night before, I talked to Jason at 10 o'clock and said, you know, I think I might be pregnant. And he said, well, take a test when you get home. I prattled on about how much fun my conference was, but how much I looked forward to getting home. You know, having absolutely no idea what was really going on in my house, which was that Jason had kidnapped and brutally sexually assaulted two women who were customers in the store where he worked part-time. And they were confined in the basement of our home, fearing for their lives. And Jason was responsible for that.
So what went through your head when you were told that this is what had gone on?
Yeah, so there I am in my hotel room. I get a knock at the door. I answer the door, and it's a uniformed police officer who says, no one's died, but I'm here about your husband, Jason. He was arrested last night. He's at the police station. He called 911 to say that he had assaulted and kidnapped these women, and he was asking for help for the police to come and rescue them from our home. So I didn't have any more than a split second to think, you know, maybe this isn't true, or, you know, what he's saying, before I knew, you know, Jason had turned himself into police. So everything I was going to hear was going to be true. And I just felt this sense of complete shattering and confusion and distress. And all I could think was what happened, you know, and what happened to you, Jason? And then who are these women? And in fact, at first I thought it was one woman, and it turned out to be two. And you know, where is she, and what's happening to her, and what's happening in the community? It was just a, you know, a complete sort of internal panic and shock and horror. And just thinking, how could he have done this?
And what had he actually done?
Yeah, so Jason had, he was at work. He worked part-time in a small health food store that was somebody's lifelong business. I consider his boss, his employer, to be really a victim in all this, in terms of what he then went through when his store became a crime scene and he, you know, endured the trauma of what had happened in there. A woman entered the store around 4 o'clock, and Jason held her at knife point, dragged her into a back room where he brutally raped her, and then he confined her in the basement of the store. About 20 minutes later, another woman came in. She was younger than the first. She was in her 20s, and he very similarly attacked her, also knocking her and strangling her to unconsciousness, and also confining her in the basement of the store. After those assaults, I guess he didn't know what he was going to do next, so he called a van rental company, and he rented a van. He brought the van to the store where he loaded the women in. He brought them to our home, which is very close by, and he carried them inside. And this was in November. It was now dark by this time. He carried them inside our house and into the basement. And in the basement, these two women, in what I can only imagine and have repeatedly imagined, in terror and in pain, bravely tried to talk with him, tried to engage him in conversation that would bring him out of whatever state he was in and back to some level of humanity in which he could relate to them and see them as human beings and start to act accordingly. And they were very successful in doing that. They talked, there were photos on the wall, and they said to him things like, is that your wife or your girlfriend? Where is she? What about your artwork? Talk to us about that. And in their statements later, they described Jason as kind of switching back and forth from being this terrifying, for lack of a better term, monster, to being someone that was even showing remorse and some sort of humanity to them. And certainly regret. He returned to the store at one point. He gathered a ladder and some rope. He was starting to formulate a suicide plan. Then he went back to our home, where the women even tried to convince him not to take his own life, that wasn't the way out, and where he answered my phone call at 10 o'clock at night, where I happily checked in with him about my day.
We're talking with Shannon Maroney about her memoir, Through the Glass. It's the story of what happened after she found out her husband had kidnapped and brutally raped two women, and what that taught her about love, accountability, and restorative justice.
You know, my first reaction in reading this was that Jason was a psychopath. And because as you talk about, you know, he switched back and forth. And a lot of people, you know psychopaths can be exceedingly charming. You know, people would never imagine that they could do terrible things. It took you a long time to understand what was actually going on, what had gone on with Jason. You know, while you were having this, what you thought was an ideal marriage, you found out later that he, in fact, had a secret life. Talk about that secret life, and then talk about what underlay, what was really going on with Jason.
Yes, I found out, you know, after, that night, Jason, after he called 911, the police came, he was arrested. He's taken into custody, where he gave a full statement of confession. He was put into a jail in solitary confinement. And he also, in his statement, confessed to having committed acts of voyeurism on me and many other people in our home over a couple of months leading up to the assault. So he set up a video camera in our bathroom, which was disgusting in and of itself. Upon learning of these crimes, which gave me official victim status in all of this, myself along with about 22 other people. I felt certainly in light of what had happened to these two women, it was nothing. I mean, it was not pleasant, but it was certainly nothing compared to what they were going through. And I just could only think, you know, who was Jason and what was going on and how could he have done this, you know, all around the time where he was getting married and so on. And I think that's what led me really to go to visit him at the jail the first time. Here he was in solitary confinement. I'm left on the outside. There's sort of a barrage of media. My house is on the front page of the paper. My own status in the community as a respected professional, a homeowner, a neighbor, a volunteer, is all suddenly now I'm the wife of a sex offender. My name had not yet been published, but I certainly feared that it would be. And I, at the same time as I was thinking, you know, what happened to him, I also thought, like, how could he do this? And in his statement to the police at the very end of it, he said, you know, just put me away. My wife never has to see me again. And I thought, no, that's too easy. How does he get to just go away and hide? And it's the first time I thought about prisons and jails and the way that they protect society from dangerous people. And that's extremely important. That shouldn't be compromised. But they also protect the people who've committed these crimes from having to face up to what they've done and give meaningful answers. And I just thought this sort of answer of just put me away, that all of us, the victims, myself, everybody who knew Jason, deserved a lot more than that. And so I decided to go to the jail and try to get some of those answers myself. And there were many visits in which I tried to understand who was Jason, what could have led to this.
You wanted to understand, but part of that understanding also involved forgiveness. What did you find out? What did underlie Jason's actions? How could he be a monster at one point and not only seemingly normal at the other point, but almost better than normal, a really kind and caring person?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's a person of great extremes, you know, great. I do believe that everything that was good about Jason was real, just as the violence and the terrible qualities of him were also real. And it took time, but just to be able to live with that duality. But I think, you know, in our conversations, maybe the most profound thing is just at the very, very beginning when my mom and dad came to the hotel where the police officer and I waited for them, just, you know, in the first 45 minutes of this, the first thing that my mom said was, "Didn't Jason know how much we loved him?" And that was my first question to Jason, because we just thought, like, how could anybody who was so loved do this? The first thing I asked him when I saw him through the glass, and that's where, you know, one of the reasons for the title of my book, Through the Glass, is seeing him there. And I just burst into tears and said, "Jason, you know, didn't you know how much we loved you, how much I loved you?" And he said, and he was sobbing, he said, "I'm sorry, I didn't really know." And I just thought, so something has happened to him. And so over many conversations that Jason and I then had in the jail, he did disclose to me a lot of childhood abuse issues, childhood sexual abuse. And when he was telling me about these things, there was a lot of pain that was very evident. But he also was very quick to say, "But that doesn't account for what I did," or, "But other people who experience what I experienced don't do this." And that's true. And thank God that that's true. But in all the years ever since then that I've been visiting prisons and sharing my story with inmates and talking with them and hearing from them, and from statistics as well, certainly what we know from professionals, there are a lot of people who are serving time, who've done terrible things, that also had terrible things done to them. And I think that's one piece of it. I think with Jason, there are some things I think I understand now, but there are still a lot of pieces of the equation that are still a mystery that I would love to see him enter into treatment for. Even, I mean, not for his release, not for his release from prison. I think he'll spend the rest of his life and his natural life in prison, but so that he could understand, so that any of us could understand, and also because we know that he's not the first person to do what he did, and he certainly isn't the last. And yeah. So I would like to see, you know, within our prison system and our jail systems, that we take a much deeper, better approach to really understanding how the mind works in someone that does this type of thing.
Now, you point out that he's going to be in prison for the rest of his life. Of course, in this country, that would have been a foregone conclusion, but not so much in Canada, where life sentences, these kinds of life sentences without parole, are only meted out to folks who have dangerous offender status. Say what that is, and that's something Jason actually wanted to have. He did not dispute. He accepted dangerous offender status.
Yeah, absolutely. And he was the first person in Canada to do that. So the dangerous offender designation is what came in and around the time that we got rid of the death penalty, which is about 40 or 45 years ago. And it is reserved for the most dangerous offenders. So sort of either repeat offenders, people with Jason's types of crime. And in Jason's case, I mean, he already had a life sentence. So the only higher sentence he could have was this dangerous offender designation, because in Canada we don't have consecutive sentences. So he couldn't, receive like another life sentence when he already had one. So from his first crime. So in fact, when he first went back to prison, it was just simply on a revoke of parole. He could have been kept in prison forever based on that. So once you've reoffended on a life sentence, you don't have mandatory parole ever again. So he could have just gone back to prison based on that fact alone. But he really needed to go through a trial process, and the victims deserve to have a court process for what had happened to them. And so the issue was raised right away around the dangerous offender designation, which Jason did say, I want to accept it. Accepting it would avoid a separate sentencing trial, which you have to have for that level of punishment. And in so many ways, I mean, Jason's remorse and accountability and pleading guilty to all the charges, these were key reasons why I was even able to be in conversation with him at all. And I stayed in conversation with him for as long as I felt that it was helping me, and that it was helping him. In our conversations, as much as I listened to Jason and had him talk about himself, I needed to tell him what was happening in the outside community, the results of what he had done, because I thought, again, this isn't fair for him to hide out in prison while all this happens and try to get him to think what the victims must be going through by even thinking about, what if it were me? And in that way, bringing him, I think, deepening his level of accountability by making him see the impact of his actions, I believe that was the only way that I could help the victims, was to bring their offender to the deepest level of account that I could without ever being able to talk with them myself.
We're talking with Shannon Maroney about her memoir, Through the Glass.
So you became very involved in this notion of restorative justice. And he also, I think it's probably fair to say that the trial, even though it didn't take place within a formal restorative justice framework, that it had many elements of it. So tell us, what is restorative justice? And then talk about the projects, the Forgiveness Project and the Leave Out Violence or Love Project that you are involved with.
So restorative justice is a victim-centered approach to crime and the effects of crime. So whereas our conventional justice system generally responds to crime with three main questions, which are, number one, what law was broken? The second one is, who did it? And the third one is, what punishment does that person deserve? Those three questions, and they're very, very important, but I think they're limited because they certainly do see an issue between the state and an accused person. And the people who are actually harmed by crime are basically left out of the process almost completely. So restorative justice takes a different approach and asks a different set of questions. And the questions are, first, who was harmed? And once we ask who was harmed in crime and in violence or any type of crime at all, then we're opening ourselves up to truly understand the ripple effect. In our own situation, you know, certainly it was the victims, the named victims of the offenses, but the two women assault victims, as well as myself and the 22 other voyeurs and victims. But also, I think the store owner, his family, my students that never saw me again, our neighbors who were terrified, you know, all the parole system, other parolees who were affected by Jason's reoffending, his parole officer who was investigated. Tons of people were directly affected and harmed by Jason's offenses. But none of those people had a voice. The only voice that the victims really had was at the very end of the trial. And I saw in a way that the victim impact statements are really used to achieve a conviction or influence sentencing. It's not about healing the person who was actually affected. So that's the first question, who was harmed? The second question of restorative justice is, what do they need? And that's inviting also the aspect of healing. I mean, what most victims of crime will say at some point is they need answers to questions, just like I needed the answers from Jason. You know, why did this happen? What was going through your mind? You know, was I targeted? All kinds of questions that people have. So what do they need to actually recover and rebuild their lives, given that you can't undo what has happened? And then the third question of restorative justice is, whose obligation is it to fulfill those needs? What can the offender do? What should they do? I mean, I see a great limit in just serving time, which is what Jason is doing now, which is what almost all of our incarcerated population in Canada and in the US and worldwide is doing, is serving time. And it's not serving it, certainly not to the people who've been harmed, not back to the community, and not even to their own institution if that's where they live. So what can the offender do? What can the community do? What resources are available and are needed by people who've been harmed to start to rebuild life, as different as it may be post-crime? You know, just led to a discovery of these extraordinary possibilities and proof that asking these different questions in a justice process, either alongside it or outside of it or after a trial, can really bring about a much higher level of satisfaction and a higher level of safety. So typically now people who go through a restorative process with an offender, and even in cases of homicide, very, you know, serious crimes, will report anywhere from a 95 to 99% satisfaction level with the restorative justice process, as opposed to a 4 to 10% satisfaction level with a criminal justice process. So I think that tells us something about the needs that victims really have in their lives. And it's not, I mean, I don't think anyone listening will think that I'm giving like a one, you know, sort of a prescription at all, but I think it's an option. And at the very least, some of these questions could be raised and would do a better service.
I have to say, I cried reading your book. I was moved by your compassion and how that developed, and ultimately by Jason's taking accountability for the terrible harm he had caused. So I felt that this was a kind of restorative justice that was something very powerful and something that the reader certainly feels as well. Your book, Sharon Maroney, is Through the Glass. I think it's an important book, and I want to thank you so much for talking with us here.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure, Francesca.
Shannon Maroney. She's a volunteer with Leave Out Violence, or LOVE, and a contributor to the International Forgiveness Project. You can read an excerpt from Through the Glass by going to writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox, or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at writersvoice, all one word. Then check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.